Wildlife Interactions. This is a briefing and public hearing, so I will turn it over to you, Stephanie. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, Commissioners, Director Unsworth. I'm Stephanie Simic, and I am the Wildlife Conflict Section Manager for the Department. And I'm happy to be here today. I want to thank you for taking the time and providing this opportunity for us to bring forward our proposed rules and revisions for the wildlife interaction rules. Not close enough, sorry. Thank you. Today I'm going to present to you the wildlife interaction rules as they were submitted on the 102. I do not intend to bring forward any recommended adjustments at this time. We have been engaged with stakeholders and are continuing our public process for commenting through the end of June, and intend after that to bring forward any recommended adjustments to the August Commission meeting. I'll go into greater detail later in the presentation, but I just wanted to state that up front. Usually I'm too loud for everybody, but I guess it's not today. Is that better? Okay, sorry about that. This presentation is fairly lengthy, but I think that we have a lot of information to provide to you, and certainly I'm open for questions. I have tried to break up the text of the presentation with some photos, so hopefully that will keep you entertained well enough, and if not, maybe I can do a little dance up here for you or something. Anyway, thank you again. I wanted to start out with just an overview. Wildlife interactions and human-wildlife conflict are increasing, not just in Washington. This is not a unique scenario for us. It's actually happening globally in other countries. Everyone seems to be dealing with a wildlife conflict of one shape, form, or another. It's not always the same across the world, but it's a very similar approach in the fact that we're trying to minimize conflicts as human populations are increasing and habitat fragmentation is occurring, demands on natural resources are increasing, and all of these things lead to scenarios where we have wildlife and humans coming into contact with one another. And not all wildlife-human interactions are negative. Some are actually positive. In some cases, actually, humans are seeking out wildlife and maybe creating a negative scenario. But nonetheless, there are both positive and negative encounters. And as we see this increasing across the world, wildlife agencies, and for that matter, any wildlife conservation or management organization, they seem to be appearing to get more and more involved in these issues because it's becoming more and more prominent. It used to be we were worried about managing just the populations of animals, but now we're really looking at wildlife-human conflicts as being a primary directive of our agencies and of our programs. As a result, of managing these human-wildlife conflict interactions, this has become a priority for our agency as well. And as our agency began to transition into these issues, we thought, well, let's take a look at some other components that are happening across our state. And I have a very interesting slide that was provided to me. This is on a 30-year increment, and it'll show you the urban and suburban growth across the state of Washington. So mind you, these are 30-year increments, and you can quickly see how habitat is changing through time and where it's projected to be in 2050. This is an indicator to me as a conflict manager that we better be prepared. We're probably going to be facing human-wildlife conflicts in the long term. And that is really why it's important for us to begin developing our program and thinking about the issues that we face. When we talk about human-wildlife conflicts in Washington, we're not talking about just, the beaver that's causing flooding in your backyard or the coyote that might be getting into the garbage can, but we're also talking about, like as I said before, people seeking out interactions with wildlife. We're talking about commercial damage to high-value crops from deer and elk and turkey. We're looking at commercial damage to commercial timber from bears peeling bark. These issues are broad and expansive and can be costly to our state. We're also looking at livestock losses from the three major carnivores that we have in this state. So all of these things combined create a very diverse program for our agency to deal with and a variety of issues to face. A lot of our effort is always expended on outreach and information and trying to reach out to the constituents and the customer base and ensuring that they're given the information that they need so that they can prevent or minimize conflicts on their own property. In the meantime, we also need to be prepared to provide them with the services that we provide as an agency. You know, we're mandated to manage wildlife species across the state, and in doing so, we're mandated to also help those constituents minimize the damage to their property. Some of the tools that we use, and it's not just unique, again, to Washington, but these are common tools across many wildlife agencies, but they include the obvious, first and foremost, population management of our wildlife species through hunting seasons and permits, special permits. But we also have been using a lot of non-lethal techniques, and you know that includes herding and hazing and cooperative fencing dollars, things like that. We use kill permits on occasion. We try to provide some level of compensation for, at the very least, the commercial agricultural and commercial livestock producers. We also have engaged in creating lure crops to alleviate some of the damage and the impact some of these farmers are feeling. And then, of course, our district bios do a lot of work with different winter feeding programs and habitat assessment programs. These are very common tools, as I said, not just in Washington, but across the nation. And using those tools, we were able to recognize some of our needs. And as the agency started to assess this ongoing issue about wildlife conflict, a decision was made to transfer several of the wildlife conflict responsibilities from our law enforcement division, who was the primary lead on these issues, to our wildlife program. And in doing so, there had to be some directive or some decision on, well, what should law enforcement still cover and what should wildlife take over? And that was quite easy, honestly. When you think about dangerous wildlife and public safety, Lord knows I don't want a biologist responding. I want a law enforcement officer responding to that issue. So that being said, the law enforcement program of our agency still maintains the dangerous wildlife component where there's a public safety issue or concern. All other responsibilities were transferred over to the wildlife conflict program under the wildlife conflict section under the wildlife conflict program. That transition or transfer occurred in 2013. And during that time, we had an opportunity to begin thinking about what do we need to be successful. And we began looking at staffing across the state. We don't have officers in every district, but we started staffing with conflict specialists located in strategic locations across the state. We are now up to 15 conflict specialists across Washington that are solely dedicated to addressing wildlife conflict issues. Also, as the program developed, we recognized the need to revise or perhaps propose new rules associated with wildlife conflict. Many of our rules needed to be reassessed given the times that they were first written. Some of those tools and techniques that they actually listed in within the rule are no longer effective or no longer in place. And so through that process, we started thinking about, well, what are our steps? And we recognize as a program, we really do need to have our rules in line so that from there we can develop the appropriate policies and the appropriate procedures for our staff to follow. And so that's what brought me to you today. As we began thinking about this program and developing it, like I said before, our transition occurred in 2013. And in 2014, we began at what I would call a fairly extensive public outreach and public input process. As we started transferring these responsibilities, we were also beginning to get public input on our game management plan. We did a online scoping survey. We received input from that. We also conducted two additional surveys that were contracted out. It was a Washington Hunter Opinion Survey and Washington Residents Opinions Survey. From those surveys and the input from the scoping process on the game management plan, we were able to begin identifying some of the concerns that our customers and users had with the existing conflict rules. We also, in addition, here more recently, when we finally drafted a draft of the proposed rules, we were able to then reach out even further and specifically to that draft and contact the Washington Forest Protection Association, the Washington Farm and Forestry Association, Washington Cattlemen's Association. We reached out to each and every one of these stakeholders to get input on the proposed revised rules. And that process has been very fruitful, from my opinion. We've really received some, I think, really good and critical review of the draft. And as I said before, we won't necessarily be bringing proposed recommended adjustments at this point, but we're continuing this comment process through the end of June. The public comment process closes the end of June, and we will be meeting again with many of these stakeholders for a second or third meeting, as well as some additional stakeholders, and from that we'll move forward with some recommended adjustments based on the draft rules. Why do we need them? Well, you know, the first and foremost is the agency, as we transition this program into wildlife, we do need some clear direction. We need agency direction on where we're going with some of the key issues that we face in wildlife conflict. But as I said before, through all those scoping processes and the surveys that we conducted, we had a lot of questions asked of us, numerous questions, and some very serious concerns about our process and what we were doing and how we were doing it. And surprisingly to me, I mean, it wasn't surprising once I read the rules, but there was a lot of confusion out there about, well, if I'm doing this, but the rules listed here, and then I look under the trapping rule, it says X, Y, and Z, how does that fit with what I'm doing? So there's a lot of confusion, and it's not just on our permits or our process, but it's, you know, even with the licenses and tags we've had. So given all of these components, we found that it was really critical. The rules are where we're going to build our foundation for this program. We've got the staff in place. We've got the skill set. Now we need the rules. So to get a little bit further in the weeds, we want to, through this proposed revisions that you have in your booklet, we want to update the existing rules, maybe provide some additional requirements for many of our users, which include the wildlife control operators, the trappers, the permit holders, the landowners that are impacted, the producers of these various commercial commodities that we have. We need to provide a framework for the producers to work with us, to understand that we are here to assist them, and we both have responsibilities. It's a collaborative effort to mitigate the wildlife conflict damage issues. And then also, the Wildlife Control Operator Program, I think it's one of our best-kept secrets at this point, and we could probably utilize it a little bit further. And so we felt there was a need to update that existing control operator program and better align it with reporting requirements and requirements that we have within the trappers program so that they align a little better for data collection, but they still keep their unique value and their separateness. What you'll see today is there are several components that we're proposing to move into the Wildlife Interaction Rules chapter, which is chapter 232-36. As I said before, some of the rules that apply to, say, bare timber damage, they're in our permanent regulations rather than under the conflict issue, but they're really related to the conflict or at least minimizing conflict from wildlife. So we're proposing to combine all those and put them into one chapter so it's easier for the consumer and the customer to find the rules that they need that apply to their issue. And then there's a lot of clarification of language in each of the rules, and it's primarily just to facilitate a better program, an improved process, and overall improved customer service. So because this is such a large package, we thought about different themes, and we've organized this into four different themes. The four of them are listed here: damage to agriculture and timber, killing wildlife and protection of property, compensation, and wildlife control operators. These really are major themes under the Wildlife Conflict Program that we deal with on a daily basis. And the other thing you'll find is there are a couple of rules that could maybe fit under another theme, but we tried to put them under the most pertinent theme. So while you may sit there and say, well, I would have put that under here, we kind of chose to put it under where it is at this presentation, but certainly there is crossover on a lot of the things that we deal with. So categorically, we're under four major themes, and we'll address each rule under each of those themes. We'll begin with the damage to timber and agriculture. And this is really a fairly extensive project and program for us. You know, when you're dealing with commercial agriculture or commercial timber, these are high-value crops. They have a lot of value to not just to those owners, but to residents across the state. And it's imperative that we're able to assist these landowners so that they're not feeling an economic loss. One of the issues we found as we started going through this scoping process and talking with stakeholders is that, you know, obviously there's a potential for a large value loss. But the thing is, you know, no matter what you say, we're still on point to assist these landowners and to help them minimize damage. We may not be able to prevent damage, but we can at least assist in minimizing. And that's where we try to think outside the box. What tools and techniques can we provide to these landowners? How can we help them so that they're not feeling the economic impact from these wildlife species and still be able to perpetuate viable populations of wildlife species in the state of Washington? So as we were going through this, we saw that the depredation hunts, which really address some of the timber damage issue as well as agricultural damage from deer and elk, and the damage prevention permit hunts, which are really deer, elk, turkey associated, they were under different rules. They weren't under that wildlife interactions chapter. So the first thing, the easiest thing immediately was like, we need to get them all in one place. So we're proposing to replace those two rules and revise them as well and put them under the wildlife interactions chapter, which is 232.36. I'll go into each one. As we went into the 232.12.25, which really has bear timber stuff, and then it also has a deer and elk segment in that original rule, we're proposing to separate those out because these two issues are large enough in themselves that they really should have standalone rules where we can work within those programs and those issues separate of each other. And then the idea to be able to clarify the appropriate definitions and references in each of those rules individually. So we're proposing to replace 232.12.25 with 232.36.320, which is in your packet. It is solely black bear timber damage depredation permit rule. It's a standalone rule just for that issue. Within that rule, we are adding references to the RCW 7715245, which talks about illegal hunting and baiting of black bears and gives the provisions for the commercial timber owners to be able to utilize feeder stations as an abatement tool. So we referenced that, and then we also added the definitions for damage to timberland so it was clear what types of properties we were talking about under this rule, and then the term removal so it was clear that we are talking about the actual removal, physical removal of these bears. We're not relocating them. We're taking them out through a killing. The next part of this was the 232.28.266, which was related to deer, elk, turkey damage prevention permits and hunts. And one of the issues came up is that the occurrence of the damage is going to vary by the species, by the season, by, you know, what agricultural crop it is this year versus last year, a variety of things, in addition to what, you know, all of us biologists focus on, which is the wildlife population levels. So given that, there was this interest in, well, we really need to talk about using permits that are going to assist these landowners with these damage issues that are in coordination with these factors that we see, these seasonal issues, these crop issues, these species population level issues. So what we're proposing here is, again, creating a standalone rule that allows us to just address deer, elk, and turkey damage. And within that rule, we're proposing that it should be 232.36.310. And within that rule, we would clarify the use of the damage prevention cooperative agreements and the damage prevention permits. So if you read in there, in the previous rule, there was some cross terminology of permits versus agreement, and it was rather confusing. So we've really tried to lay it out where there's a clear definition of what the permit is versus what the cooperative agreement is. And again, we separate out the deer and elk from turkey. Turkey are a separate issue. We also had a couple other changes within this rule that I think are really pertinent to what we're trying to achieve as we move forward with creating what I want to be the nation's best wildlife conflict program, by the way. So as we move forward with trying to do that, we were beginning to look at these seasonal issues. We were looking at harvest levels. And under the new rule, we are further proposing that we adjust the removal quotas that are currently in place. Elk populations in many areas, particularly some of these areas, are exceeding the current management objectives. Or we don't really have a concern that if we increased, you know, this minimal amount of the quota, that it would have a negative impact on the population overall. They're fairly robust and resilient. In addition, in some of these areas, we are finding that there are increasing complaints. And so to address these concerns, we are proposing that we would increase the antlerless elk removal for damage permits. The current quota is 200. We're proposing that we increase it to 300 statewide. And along those lines, we would like to separate out a limit for both eastern and western Washington. And as you can see, we're proposing a 200 quota for eastern Washington and a 100 quota for western Washington. As we go down the list here, looking at, again, antlerless elk, but we're looking at them solely in GMUs 372 and 379. We would like to increase that quota by 10, going from 60 to 70. The elk spike antlerless quota in elk area 3721, we would like to increase it by 50 to the total of a 100 quota. Any bull, elk 3721 again, we would like to increase that area to 60. And then elk antlerless and GMUs 501 to 578, we currently have a quota of 50, and we would like to increase that to 100 as well. Along the lines of increasing the quota, additionally, to better align this tool with the period of time that we're experiencing damage, we are proposing that we change the start dates and close dates for a few of these options. For deer and elk, we are proposing that the start date change statewide from August 1st to July 1st. And for antlerless and spike elk in elk area 3721, we are proposing the same change where we propose a new start date of July 1 versus the older start date of August 1st. We are not proposing any changes to the close dates of either one of those. For any bull in elk area 3721, we're not proposing to change the start date. We think that aligns very well. However, we would like to change the close date to June 30th rather than July 31st based on the provision of the proposed change for the elk spike antlerless in 3721 being changed to a July 1st start date. For turkey, there were minimal changes other than we do have a couple recommendations as well for quota and start dates. We would like to increase the turkey removal under the damage prevention permits from a 200 quota to a 300 quota statewide, and that is in the GMUs 105 to 130. Additionally, the current start date is October 10th, which for many folks seemed a little random at some times. So we are proposing let's have a start date of October 1st, which will fit the need for the season of when we have damage occurring, but also is quite honestly easy for folks to remember. So the next segment of this damage to agriculture and timber is really we had the need to clarify the roles and responsibilities of the department and the landowners when we're addressing these issues for big game. This is proposing a new rule, actually. This is one that we thought, based on experience with landowners and feedback we received during the game management plan scoping process, we felt this would be a good measure for all of us involved. It's primarily to assist the landowner in understanding what's expected from the department and understanding that they actually do have some responsibilities to help us help them. We want to be helpful. We want to be there to assist them, but we also aren't able to just seek out everybody. And so we're clarifying that, you know, owners really, if you're having damage, please reach out to us. You know, we'll try to assist you as best we can, but we need you to reach out to us. We can't reach out. There's only a few of us. We can't reach out to everyone and know that you might be the one having damage. So we want to clarify that because oftentimes we do get some calls saying, well, you know, nobody came by. And the response is, well, we would if we were aware, but we didn't know you were experiencing damage. And I don't want us to be saying that we didn't know, because I want us to be like, okay, we're there. We're there. We're coming there for you. Although we try to reach out to as many landowners as we can, especially when we have issues going on in a certain area, we'll try to reach out to the adjacent landowners and assist them. Sometimes we miss a few, or we're not as successful as predicting where all the damage is going to occur. The other thing was to just illustrate again that this is really a collaborative working relationship. It's us working with those landowners and vice versa, and it's about building those relationships and working together to be successful to minimize damage. And so this rule will help us do that. The other part of this rule is that oftentimes we find that we are encouraging landowners to use some non-lethal preventative tools or to try some different techniques, and we are met with resistance at times. There is some resistance. So they may have justifiable reasons why they're resisting the assistance or the suggestions that we're making. So we are requiring or requesting that a documentation that the landowner is refusing assistance, that be made, so that it's on record that at least this part was recommended to them and they're refusing it, and then providing them an appeals process. Because if they have a valid reason on why they're not wanting to engage in what we're proposing, there needs to be a way for them to leverage that and say, no, this is why, and it's justified, and then we can move forward from there. Otherwise, we kind of run into a stalemate where we're there recommending things and no one's making any headway. And that's not good for us, and that's not good for the landowner, because the damage continues. Or worse than that, you all get more involved. And we don't need to have you getting calls from our customers when we could be resolving it ourselves. One component of this is if it is deemed that their denial of our assistance is results in a noncompliance, then they would not be eligible for compensation. The other issue that came up through this process was the issue of hunting pressure. And we recognize as conflict managers that hunting pressure is really effective. When you have human presence out there, whether it's the form of hunting pressure or a range rider or just having that human presence, it can be an effective tool in minimizing damage from wildlife. So what we try to do, obviously, is try to provide opportunities for our hunters that are licensed hunters, that they can help us with damage issues and get out there for an additional opportunity, foster good relationships with those landowners, not just between us, but between them and the hunters as well. And it's become really a part of our program to encourage the use of hunters for mitigating damage. So with this, we have a rule that is already in existence, but we did have some questions or some clarification we wanted to make on this rule to help facilitate and improve the way we use it. This is more clerical, I would say, but we have this term species causing damage. We wanted to put that in there so that folks recognize, hey, we really want to emphasize the effort on those species that are causing you damage. But because we recognize there is this value in having hunting pressure on other species, we want to allow that as well. So it's just an additional of species causing damage and still allowing for the species, other species to be hunted or hazed to remove the damage issue. Now, yes.
On that one, I can see your point, but I know here a few years ago it came down that if you're going, we were having quite a bit of trouble with elk.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get any kind of permit, you had to open up all your ground.
Yeah.
And I can see your point, and it's very valid, but I don't think one should be contingent on the other.
Yeah, and Commissioner, I've got your point, okay. And I understand where you're coming from.
And that's the way it came across, but I just want to clarify.
That was not the intent, that it was one is contingent upon the other, but we'll clarify that in the language.
No, and I took it that you meant it that way. Yeah. All I want to do is just emphasize that. That's very important.
Yes, sir. The other issue that we had with this, and again, this is more clerical, is we used to have what was called an access agreement. We no longer have just an access agreement. We have multiple agreements. We have a variety of agreements. So we're proposing to remove that term and just allow it to be standalone as just agreements. Along with this clerical revision to this rule, we are proposing also that the previous rule stated prevent damage. Very often prevention may not be feasible, but minimizing the damage or minimizing the impact is. And so we are proposing to add the terminology minimize or prevent damage. And then we are also just, again, trying to reiterate that collaborative process with the landowner and the department in stating that both they work together in choosing the number of hunters, the timing of when it occurs, and the weapons that are used, obviously under the ordinances of the local area. But in the past, I think it's been a perception that we're dictating how many and where and when and how, and this really needs to be more of a collaborative process with the landowner and our staff. So that's the other change we're proposing to this rule. Well, you're a quarter way through, so we survived the first round. The next is killing wildlife and protection of property. This theme, again, you know, these were all chosen because they're fairly extensive in the amount of time and effort we put into each of these activities. One of the primary issues we had with this, under this theme, was really that, you know, obviously we all know and we understand the department recognizes the need for landowners to protect their property. But we also noted quite a bit of confusion in when the landowner can do this, what their abilities are, particularly when you're talking about various species and various protection levels, whether it's federal or state and those sorts of things. And so we decided there needed to be some clarification on the limitations and the requirements. And, you know, the other component that came up is what do you do with it after you've removed it or you've taken care of the situation? How do you dispose of this? And there was confusion on that as well. So we tried to address those points within these revisions. Under this topic, we have three specific rules that we're going to be looking at. The first one is 232-36051, which is killing wildlife causing private property damage. The second one is 232-36055, which is the disposal component. And then the last one is 232-36510, which is failure to abide by the conditions of the permits or reporting requirements. We'll go into each one of these. With the first one, there's quite a bit of confusion on the various permits that we have, and we There was confusion also with the damage prevention cooperative agreements and how they relate to the various permits. Again, throughout our rules, we sort of switch back and forth between agreement and permit and certification, and it gets a little wonky. People don't quite understand what we're referring to, and I'm not sure that maybe when they were written, they were all in place at the same time anyway, so there is some confusion. We intended then to note that we want to be able to clarify those differences between, again, the damage prevention permit and kill permit, as well as the damage prevention cooperative agreement. We also wanted to remove permit types that we no longer issue. We, through this process of taking over wildlife conflict under the program, the wildlife program, we've refined the number or the types of permits from what used to be 7 different types of conflict-related permits down to basically 3 structures. And so we needed to get rid of those permits that were no longer in existence. We wanted to revise the nomenclature throughout the document. Again, is it a permit? Is it a certificate? Is it an agreement? That sort of thing. And then consolidate all of this under each of the permits. The next question or issue that came up under this killing of wildlife for protection of property was related to, again, the disposal of the animal carcasses. What does a landowner need to do? How do we handle it? What if it's, you know, like I said before, it's confusion of when and how to dispose of it, but also about the species and the reporting requirements of when you dispose of the animal, who do you have to report to, do you have to have a permit, those sorts of things. So in that, we tried to clarify the language, and if you look through your binder, you'll see clarifying language that details the carcass disposal when you have a permit. Generally, the carcass disposal will be, not generally, it should be indicated on the permit. If you have a kill permit or a damage prevention permit, it should be directing you how to dispose of that carcass. Then we added language to direct those customers that perhaps are taking wildlife without the permit but are in protection of their property, what do they need to do with those carcasses. So we added that language into this rule. And then, again, here's one of those rules that probably could go under the wildlife conflict, wildlife control operator rules, or it could fit here. There was confusion regarding the reporting requirements, especially with a wildlife control operator that may have been contracted by a landowner. Who has to report? Who's on point for that? And so we tried to clarify the language under there. We changed the language primarily to reflect the correct title for the wildlife control operators and the correct title for their certification versus the permit and I think they called them control officers. So we corrected that, and then it clearly states that, you know, if a wildlife control operator has a carcass, this is what they need to be doing. This is their reporting requirement. And it follows along the lines of our trapper reporting as well. Then one of the other components that we had, you know, we have these rules for bear timber damage. We have rules for deer and elk damage. We have a public safety cougar removal program. We have all of these different issues. But what happens when you just have, you know, a bear or a cougar that comes in and takes your livestock? So we realize that there are times where we're removing animals in response to a depredation event, and those are not related to any of the other structures that we have in place. So we needed a rule that was just going to address these types of removals. So we're proposing a new rule, which is 232.36.330, bear and cougar depredation permit hunts for domestic or livestock losses, domestic animal or livestock losses. This is intended to address the need to respond to those issues. It clarifies that we are only going to use, as a department, we will only use hunters authorized by us. It does require a permit for this type of removal, and it requires 24-hour reporting of take and then 48 hours after that to dispose of the carcass. So compensation is our next theme. And with compensation, again, And I was just saying, actually, this morning, prior to 2010, claims for agricultural damage alone were generally in excess of $100,000 to $120,000 a year that the agency would pay. Since 2010, when we brought in some additional tools, we had some conflict staff that had been working for a couple of years in certain areas, we began averaging about $60,000 to $80,000 a year in damage. We're right at about 80 this year, just under 80 actually this year. So compensation is a very large piece for us, particularly with the agricultural side of it. And we recognized that we needed to really refine the interpretation of our rules on those, on this issue. There were quite a lot of misperceptions regarding when someone could file, what their role was to file for a claim, the responsibilities of them. There were some thought they couldn't, some of our ag producers thought they couldn't file a claim because there was no money. It was very confusing. So, and in addition, others thought they had to use an ag appraiser that they had to pay for. So this rule in itself just needed quite a bit of work, honestly. If you look through the booklet, you'll see there was quite a bit put into it. But we have three rules that actually associate with the commercial crop damage payments, the application, and then, of course, the application for the livestock damage component or domestic animal component. So we thought it best to address all of these, and we found that that was a good decision based on the input and concerns that were raised by our stakeholders. So there was, again, confusion about the Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement. And so this is going to help us clarify what that agreement is for, the intent of the preventative measures, and how they can utilize that agreement to the best of their to their best interest for filing claims. We added the language to correctly reflect that Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement within the Rule 232-36-100, which is the payment. We also clarified the process for denial of claims, and this links back to that proposed 232-36-090 rule that we were trying to clarify the limitations and what the roles and responsibilities are for us versus the landowner. So this reflects back to that. And no other changes were needed at this point. Once we got those few things cleaned up, that rule seemed to be fairly straightforward. The next thing was the confusion with the claims process and the terminology. Throughout this rule, we used three or four different terms for the claimant, the landowner. We used the landowner, the claimant, and the applicant. And I understand if you think about the process as you go through it, they start out as a landowner, then they become an applicant, then they become a claimant. But by goodness, it just created all kinds of confusion for folks. So we tried to clarify that through this and then through the next, the livestock component as well. And we just tried to really articulate clearly what the process was so that folks weren't surprised or disappointed, and also for our staff as well. Again, this is really to direct us. We need some clear direction to help our staff be successful. And so by going through these rules, we're able to really clean up what our actions are and what our intent is. So when we revised the application for compensation for commercial crop damage, the procedure rule, which is 232-36-110, we changed the package due dates. And this is an error on my slide, and I apologize for that. We changed the package due date from when damage stops to 60 days of harvest because we found that several landowners will have multiple harvests. And so the damage might stop after the first harvest, but then they might have another harvest. And so we changed it to that and to allow them the ability to claim over the period of their season. If needed, they can file one claim over the period, and they can notify us. By working with the conflict staff in the field, the conflict staff will have a pulse on what's going on there with their claim and with their harvest, and they'll be able to work with the adjuster and the landowner to make sure that everything is accounted for. The other proposed change is adding the requirement of the Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement or the waiver. And the waiver, again, goes back to that proposed rule of 232-36-090, where it identified the roles and responsibilities and allowed the landowner to appeal the preventative measures that were offered. And then it clarified the documentation required. There was some confusion that they had to submit all their tax forms and, you know, the name of their firstborn child and all this crazy things. I mean, we heard all kinds of stuff. But and I understand it is confusing. When you read the rules, they can be confusing. So we tried to clarify what was really required to apply for the compensation. This is a fairly lengthy one, and it's an important one for us. We further tried to clarify that really the adjusters are there to work for the landowner, and it's imperative, it's really imperative for the landowner to work directly with those adjusters to ensure that the adjuster is seeing the property damage, to assure that they're getting the crop values, and let the landowner show him where the damage is occurring, how often it occurs. They need to work together. It's not there's been some misperception about this is our adjuster, and so the landowner just has to let them do their thing, and that's not true. So we want to try to clarify that and emphasize that collaborative process again. Again, clarifying the use of an owner-selected a crop adjuster versus the WDFW contracted adjuster. Folks thought that they had to get their own adjuster, and they had to foot the full bill. And it was like, well, you can choose one of ours, and we'll cost share it, or you can choose your own, and at that point, yes, you will. So we tried to clarify that within this proposed revision. Then also we tried to clarify when you might be denied for your claim and noncompliance. And then the last piece here is removing the negating adjuster fees for claims over $10,000. This caused confusion. So many folks thought that if they claim didn't reach $10,000, then again they were on the hook for paying the full price of the adjuster. And if their claim was only $4,000, they were going to and the adjuster cost them $1,000. They were only going to receive $3,000. So we're trying to clarify. So we took that out because it just caused major confusion. We just figured let's just remove that. The process is the cost share up to $600. It's either half the cost share of the. The adjuster fee is either half the total fee or up to $600, and that's all the owner is on the hook for as far as paying or cost sharing. It would be $600 max. So we changed that, just removed this confusion piece, and hopefully that will help folks understand the process a little bit better. Another component of the compensation is the livestock piece, and revisions, again, were needed to ensure that with livestock, it's been interesting. We've had a couple of cases that we just went through, and I guess you live by experience many times. But so we found that the deadlines that were initially written in the rules probably aren't going to fit most of the scenarios that we deal with livestock losses. And so we said, okay, we need to make sure that these owners have adequate time to file their claims and they understand what they need to do in order to file an appropriate claim. So we propose to revise 232.36.210, application for cash compensation for livestock damage or other domestic animals, by the following. We added a component in there that says, hey, notify us within 30 days of your loss that you intend to file a claim. That's just putting us on notice that, okay, you know, Mr. So-and-so, we expect that you're going to be filing a claim. Thank you for letting us know. And we would create, you know, the format for them to be able to do that. The other thing we did was we changed and, in fact, extended the submission of the complete claims package. Now, originally, they had to notify us within 10 days. So now we're saying notify us within 30 that you intend to file. Then they had to file within 30 days. And we say, well, you know, based on our experience so far, that's probably not an adequate period of time for these people to be able to file their claim. So we're recommending in the proposed revisions that we give them 60 additional days. So that gives them a total of 90 days to file their claim. And then we further clarified the assessment of losses caused by wolves or other carnivores and how that is what paperwork is associated with that and how that is determined.
Steph?
Yes.
And I should have stopped you a long time ago.
Okay.
It was pertaining to the bears, mountain lions.
Would you like me to go back to that slide?
That'd be great.
Okay. Let me see if I can find
it. You had to have a permit.
This one?
Bears and cougars may need to be removed.
Yes.
And you had to have a permit.
Yes. That's not, go ahead.
Okay, you're reading my mind.
Yes, sir, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. There again, if a bear's eating on a dead cow, you're probably going, oh, the cow died and the bear's eating her. But if you catch a mountain lion eating on a calf, you're probably going to assume that the mountain lion killed it. You don't need to go file for a permit, correct?
That's correct, sir.
Okay.
And it's probably on my cheat sheet that I didn't read. This does not affect those that are in the act of attacking.
Okay.
This the changes, the provisions that we are suggesting for killing wildlife and protection of property does not change that line item.
Okay.
That the owners are still able to take wildlife that are actually in the act of damaging or attacking their livestock, their crops, one game animal. Yes, that's still on the books.
Okay.
I apologize if
I... No, I was sure that was what you want, but I just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Mr. Keeney.
Thank you. Just so I understand, so a species, though, that is still considered statewide endangered like wolves doesn't necessarily fall under this at all until such time as when they're not considered endangered. So is that a separate set of rules that will come out of the Wolf Advisory Group, for instance, on compensation for... livestock damage by a protected species?
So you're correct.
Okay.
And it still remains, if you read through the provisions of the proposed rule, that there is actually a separate provision for wolves specifically, okay, because of the scenario that we currently have in the state of Washington that addresses that issue.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If I may, too, now, I understand that the landowner will still have to pay up to $600 to have an assessment of the damage. Is that correct?
That's correct. If the assessor goes out and the fee is, say, $100, it's a cost share of 50-50. But if it's more often than not, most of these claims, and trust me, our staff work very closely with these owners to ensure that, you know, they have a legitimate claim so that they're not expending extra time or effort or anything. And so when it reaches the point that, you know, the conflict staff says to the landowner, or the landowner says to the conflict staff, you know, I think I need to file a claim, and the conflict staff agrees, they provide them the information packet to begin that process. And the landowner will then contact headquarters, and we will give them a list of appraisers that they can use if they choose to use a contracted appraiser through WDFW. They can choose their own. Now, if they do choose their own, they need to pay they have to pay the assessor. If they choose one we have on contract, the rule currently is that we would cost share it 50%, and then the maximum a landowner would have to pay would be $600. And I'll be honest with you, sir, most of them are well in excess of $600. Most of the assessment fees are above $1,500 for one damage claim. So most times the agency is actually providing a greater amount towards the cost share than the landowner, but it is up to $600. And that's currently in rule. That's not a proposed change. It's just we tried to clarify that for folks.
All right. And then these claims probably must be well in excess of that fee. They must be getting compensated for.
It varies, honestly. We've had several claims that are right around between the $6,000 and $10,000 mark. We've had a few that are in excess of the $10,000.
Okay.
Just to clarify that, though, I mean,
You
know you're going to have some deer and elk damage.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the game. You know, you do. Mm-hmm. That's just part of the game. But when you start having these total wipeouts, major blows, that's when this will come into play.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. Just to add a little note to that, too, some of these other programs that we have, like the lure crops, many of the landowners are willing to take an additional loss in participating in that lure crop approach and don't file a claim because they participate in that and they choose to offset it that way. But really, most of the landowners, they do expect a certain percentage of loss and they're willing to accept a certain level. But once it exceeds that, you know, we want to be able to provide them an efficient means to apply for a claim and a compensation piece. And so they will then reach out to us at that point.
But we do. We live where we live and do what we do because we enjoy the game.
Right.
But when it starts really starting biting on you, that's when you need to.
Okay. good.
Okay. Let me see if I can get to where we were. Okay, so we're ready to tackle wildlife control operators. Well, you guys are doing well. Maybe it's all the pretty pictures, right? No. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, wildlife control operators, they're really a useful tool for our program. These folks really tackle the everyday raccoon and opossum and skunk and all of these crazy environmental things that we deal with in urban and suburban areas that, quite frankly, the agency at the present time doesn't have the staff to be sending out 50 or so people to address raccoon problems. But these control operators are there. They're willing to help. The nice thing about them is that we've created this list online, and so it further facilitates the idea that the landowner can take responsibility, they can take action on their own, they can call us up, get the list, or they can go online, get the list, find a control operator within their area, and have them contracted to come assist them on their property. One of the issues that we found in going through this process is that, again, there was this confusion through the old rules and even through various processes that we've had over time about the certification, the permits, the types of traps that they can use, what were the reporting requirements, did they even have to report, and you know, as I mentioned, I think, earlier to a few of you, being from the wildlife program, we're data-driven. So, yes, we would like to have the report. We'd like to know where these conflict issues are occurring, what species are, you know, involved, and how are the issues being resolved. So we propose under this theme, there are three rules that we feel are directly related to this issue. The first one is 232.12.142, which is the special trapping permit. And the way it was written under the use of body gripping traps. And so what this rule did was it kind of mixed things a little bit. It had the use of the body gripping traps within the special trapping permit, and then it also had some additional trapping components to it. So what we're proposing to do is to split these out, and you will see that in a minute. We'll go into detail on that one. The next component was the 232.36.060, which gives us, through the director, it gives us the authority to grant a control operator a certification. And then the last piece of this is the authority through the director for the wildlife control operator to then have a permit to address the wildlife interaction. So, again, as I was mentioning, we needed separate and clear direction for the use of special trapping permits and the conditions for the use of body gripping traps. And the interpretations that we've been receiving and hearing from other folks, there's very different rules on what they had to do with the carcass, how they could, if they could retain the carcass, what permits they needed, how many renewals they could get, those sorts of things. So this is why we decided to go ahead and move forward with trying to revise this. Under this rule, what we are attempting to do, again, is to separate the use of body gripping traps from just the special trapping permit, so that this rule would then just be affiliated with special trapping permits, the permit itself, not the use of the traps, but the permit. And then we further clarified the term permit. Throughout the document, it referred to permit, and then some sites it would say special trapping permit. So in the revised proposed rule, we clarified that special trapping, the term permit, literally means special trapping permit under this rule. We also removed the application details. We felt that was fairly redundant to the permit application itself, and also some of it was actually even redundant to an RCW. So we felt that wasn't necessary in our rule, so we removed that. The next issue was separating out the certification of the wildlife control operators and the permits that are associated for use by a wildlife control operator. Again, terminology was mixed here, so we tried to clarify and make them separate pieces to eliminate the confusion and hopefully provide clearer direction for both the users of the wildlife control operators but the control operators themselves. We changed the name to certifying or to certifying wildlife control operators so that it indicates this is solely about the certification process and not about the permitting. We set it up or established this in the proposed rule that a control operator needed to be certified before they can receive a permit to take action. We listed some criteria. We're proposing that they possess a, which this was actually in rule before, that they possess a state trapper education exam, that they complete that, they pass it, and then that they also possess 2 years of demonstrated experience. We've had a couple of scenarios where we've had control operators, the day after they pass their trapper's exam, they take the WUCO, the wildlife control operator course, and then the next day they call us up and ask us if we have traps or can we recommend traps that they can use and ask for advice, leaning towards the idea that perhaps some of these individuals didn't have quite the skill set that others do. And we don't want to be putting folks out there that aren't fully prepared to do what they need to do. It's not good for those control operators that do have the experience, and it's not good for us as an agency when we're trying to, you know, list these folks as additional help. So we're proposing that we require them to have 2 years of demonstrated experience. And through this, as I mentioned before, we've been working with the stakeholders. We got some good feedback on this. We can establish a process for that to occur and assure that they have a checks and balances for the 2 years. The other part of this, we're suggesting that we remove the date from the fee change. That information is redundant to, I believe it's an RCW. And then we are, again, changing the term permit to certification so that it's clear this is the certification. The permit is actually what gives you the authority to move forward with a specific incident. Here we needed the next rule that we're proposing to change. The issue that came up is that they need a clarification on responsibilities and requirements for the control operators under both the certifications and the permits. And so what we proposed here under 232.36.065 is that we change the title to reflect the use of the wildlife control operators versus just permitting and certifying them. Actually saying this is we're going to use these guys and this is how we would utilize them. We want to also specify wildlife control operators are permitted to conduct the work outside of designated seasons to help the landowners with damage issues, because there was some confusion that they could only work during trapping seasons. Well, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of the wildlife control operator. When we don't have a trapping season, it's challenging. How do you get folks out there to help? So that we clarified that. We also wanted to clarify that the body gripping traps do require that additional special trapping permit. It's not just the permit to go out and do the job as a wildlife control operator, but it's a permit to actually use that type of trap. And then further, we were attempting to clarify the retention of animal furs by wildlife control operators and stating that they could retain furs in season only and with certain conditions. Again, trying to alleviate the confusion of when they can retain and when they couldn't and what they had to do to dispose of the animals. Further, we clearly stated that the disposal of animals was required with those animals that were trapped using a body gripping trap. We proposed that we adjusted the reporting requirements so it better aligned with the trapping reporting requirements. Many of these guys are also trappers, so that would just help them report during the same time frames. And then we also clarified the period for which a certification or a permit may be denied or revoked and the terms for which that might occur. The next piece of the Wildlife Control Operator Program was just trying to provide, again, that separate guidance on the use of the body gripping traps, separate of the trapping, separate of the special trapping permit, just its own standalone guidance rule. So under this, we have the report of the required report required of the certified wildlife control operator, and then we have the use of the body gripping traps and the exceptions to that. These are proposed new rules. We needed to alleviate the confusion of how and when they report and whether or not there were penalties for failure to report. We do have penalties for failure to report for our trappers, and therefore we also have penalties associated with failure to report on these. The WUCO, again, follows the same process and violations and stipulations as the trappers, and we specify a reporting date for them, which aligns with the report for requirements for trappers. We do reference a web-based reporting component and appropriate forms, which if these rules are put forward and as proposed and approved through the August meeting, we will ensure that we have that web-based availability immediately. We also clarified that false reports or failure to report is considered an infraction. There was some question to that. We worked with our law enforcement on all of these rules and regs, and they helped support many of the issues related to the violations and infractions. This is, I've already stated that we did this. In April of 2015, during the commission meeting, the original rule 232.12.141 did already remove components of the body gripping trap from the original rule. And so we're just following suit and ensuring that we have a rule that addresses that under the wildlife conflict chapter. This is a new rule that we're proposing. It's 232.36.051. It's the use of the body gripping traps. Again, like I said, we removed it from 232.12.141. We're just ensuring that we have it. It's in place, and it's under the wildlife conflict chapter. Under this rule, we're also ensuring that we list the RCW that is associated with this, which defines the traps, and rather than having a long laundry list of traps, we're just referencing that RCW. We corrected the trap time check time frame in RCW. It states that it needs to be 24 hours. We corrected that. The rule used to say 72, but it does need to be 24 based on RCW. So we corrected that parameter. And that brings me to the end here. Again, the revisions that we're proposing will really help establish some direction for the agency. It provides not just clear direction to us, but also to our user groups, our consumers, our customers, and other folks. Additionally, it's going to help us, through minimizing the confusion and having some clear direction, it'll help us facilitate improved policies and standard operating procedures for our staff. We'll be able to address concerns that have been expressed to us from our constituents and our stakeholders. It's going to, in the long term, I'm convinced that having a solid set of rules to follow under will foster improved relationships with our customer bases and improve our processes. And hopefully, I mean, I'm really looking forward to us really building a strong collaboration between our staff and the landowners that are affected by wildlife and wildlife conflict issues. And again, I'll state it again just because sometimes I get a little carried away, but I'd really like to see Washington have the nation's best conflict program. And the only way to do that is to really have a strong structure from which to build from. So I appreciate your time and listening to all of this. I do want to kind of reiterate the next steps for our process here. We obviously have the public hearing today, but we also extended our open comment period through to June 30th. So that's still ongoing. Hence another reason why I didn't necessarily want to bring forward some recommended adjustments at this point. We are going to continue working with the stakeholders. As I mentioned before, we had some really good input provided by some stakeholders. Appreciate their involvement. We've been trying to work very closely with certain groups as we move forward in revising several programs, which I think several of them will come up here and talk to you about some of their concerns. But we've worked closely, particularly on the bare timber issue. It's been an ongoing program and an ongoing concern for the agency and for those commercial timber and private timber owners. And we've worked to construct a subcommittee of our team and a few other folks, including some partnering agencies, that is going to literally address this issue and this program, and we've had the WFFA and WFPA come out and talk to us about their concerns and their issues and really trying to engage a collaborative effort there in improving that program and making sure we have a program that meets their needs and still addresses the concerns that we have as we move forward with managing wildlife populations. I will be bringing forward in August, after we have all these meetings and discussions and we make some recommended adjustments, I'll be bringing those forward to you all in August. I look forward to that. I think we'll have even a tidier package than you've seen today, so I'm anxious to get that tidied up for you. And then, as I stated before, once we've come to a point where we have some rules that have been approved, we have recommendations from you all, we will begin developing our policies and revising our SOPs to facilitate a strong program. I'd be happy to take any questions. Appreciate your time.
Mr. Holzman.
I guess more of a comment than a question, that this is a very, very positive program that we've had going. We've had elk issues forever. And when it was in the enforcement hands, it just didn't seem like we ever got very good answers, and it was a bad position because then that made the producers not like the enforcement people, and it was just no. And then we've been very blessed with the conflict specialists we have down there. They've just been fat, you know, and there again, this was before I even got on the commission. They were really good to work with and are very interested in doing their job. And just like you said this morning, it puts it in a whole different realm because the enforcement people had their projects and their jobs to do, and this was just kind of secondary. And now we have the conflict specialists that this is their job, and there again, we're blessed. The ones we've got want to do their job and do it good. So
thank you.
I just want to second what Commissioner Holtzmiller said. It really has been great seeing this program build, and I admire your goal. It's the best in the nation. I did find an edit in WAC 232-36-054, use of body grouping traps and exceptions, paragraph 2A, to protect the public health and safety. So the department works well with the other agencies, other state agencies. It's not in consultation with the Department of Social and Health Services. It's in consultation with the Department of Health. The Department of Health is a state agency now that handles public health as opposed to the. So this was obviously taken out of old language.
Yes, thank you very much for that correction. Yeah. You're correct. We did take it from a document we had received
and
called and said, is this still on the books? And they said yes. And we're like, okay, that sounds good. I appreciate that correction.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you, Stephanie. That was outstanding. And again, seconding Commissioner Thornburg's comment for your dedication to the task and wanting to see us number one. That's good.
Yep. Thank you, Mr.
Your commitment came through with the very quality time, put a lot of time into your presentation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I would encourage any of you, if you have an opportunity to meet our conflict specialists, they're just as dedicated and passionate as I am. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
And we do have several public comments for public testimony. And again, everybody I think knows the rules that 3 minutes, the buzzer goes off, and you can finish your sentence or your thought, but within a few more seconds. So I'll call you up two at a time. Bruce Vandervoort and Sean Cantrell. I should get that, Sean, after a while. I just always concentrate on the last name. You got to spell it.
I'll improve my pen.
Yeah. Well, it's better than mine. So Bruce, take it away.
Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Vandervoort. I'm the president of the Washington State Trappers Association. We represent over 600 trappers and wildlife control operators in Washington. We also do all of the trapper education classes in the state, and we have done the life control operator classes for the department, all without compensation. It's all volunteer. Of course, I'm going to be specifically speaking to the trapping portion, but we're not really happy with some of the things that we've been reading in the proposed changes. We were told there were clarifications to start with, but actually we found some of them to be quite a bit more restrictive than current law. I wrote a letter that I think each of you have detailing our concerns. I don't know that I'll have time to go through each one of them, but enough to say we have problems with some of the changes. Washington has some of the most restrictive trapping laws in the United States, and I do not really understand why the department would move to further restrict us. We're especially concerned about the changes regarding retention of fur, raw fur, by WCOs outside of season, and also retention of raw fur taken on the special trapping permits. Currently, the WCOs can pretty much keep the fur taken outside of the season. Now, it's pretty much worthless, all right. But what concerns us is we use a lot of that fur in our fur handling portion of our trapper education program. And without them holding some of it over for us, it's going to create a real problem for us. And we also don't feel that there should be any changes to the law on the retention of fur, raw fur, by people that have a special trapping permit. The RCW and the initiative that was responsible for the RCW. I didn't get very far, did I? Well, anyways, I'll just close off to say that we hope to work with Stephanie and Mick, and I would also like to just mention that Bobby Thornley wanted to be here today to speak about this, but could not be here due to a doctor's appointment. So I had a lot left to say, but I don't speak fast enough, I guess. So.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Brad? Yes. Now, you say you've submitted a letter, because there again,
I gave it to the person out here,
okay,
a copy of for each one of you.
There again, I didn't get many of your concerns before they fell, so
oh.
That was... I know you have them, but I mean, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, if you want me to go into some of them, I already mentioned the retention of raw fur. We are unhappy with a lot of the provisions dealing with the WCOs because we just think it's going to create a lot of red tape for them. That's not really going to help the situation. I know Stephanie mentioned the 2 year that you wouldn't be able to get a WCO permit for 2 years after, and she said that it says a minimum of 2 years experience that demonstrates the knowledge and ability to control wildlife species. I'm not really sure how the department is going to be able to have people demonstrate that experience. They go to the any trapper to get a WCO permit, he has to go through the trapper education program. He then has to go through the WCO permit program. And I'm not sure what else you can do. I mean, and it will create some problems for some companies that hire people and then train them on the job. So, which that's very few WCOs, but there is that problem. And then another thing that, and this really doesn't affect trappers too much, but we are against giving department employees or agents an exemption from the setbacks for setting traps near meat bait. That was put in to from meat bait. So if you have a carcass, like an animal carcass, it's against the law to set a foothold trap within 30 feet. And there's a very good reason for that. That's to avoid catching raptors. And we just feel that it's not necessary, and it will come back to bite you, and it'll make trappers look bad too if somebody out there catches a hawk or an eagle. So,
Bruce, all of those comments are in the letter?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. That will be distributed to us.
I'm sure there's enough to go around, so I would appreciate it if you give them more than just a cursory look.
And then we will share that with Stephanie as well.
So. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Leonard Wolf, please. Sean?
Thank you again, Sean Cantrout, Defenders of Wildlife. I appreciate the work that staff has already put into this and the commission's interest at looking at cleaning up the different inconsistencies in these regs and clarifying some of the things. I want to focus today on one section, the 232.36.210, which deals with the livestock damage compensation. And there's several specific suggestions that are sort of house cleaning that I will deal directly with Stephanie on some definitions and conflicting use of terms that seem to have slipped through the cracks. But two substantive issues I want to highlight for you is the first of the two is under the higher than normal livestock losses claims, it does require the claimant or the applicant or owner to document or demonstrate compliance or demonstrate that they have a, what's the term, the preventative measures checklist or a damage prevention cooperative agreement, which we highly support and think that's great. For normal losses, however, there is no such requirement, and we think that it's completely consistent and appropriate for any claim that would also demonstrate how they've complied with the checklist or that they are in a cooperative agreement with the department. So that would be a change that I would suggest that you all consider if it doesn't come forward from staff directly. But I'll talk with Stephanie about that. The second is if a claimant does not get their request approved, then there's a separate section of the WAC that is a dispute resolution, and I think that this section should at least reference that. If we're not going to combine them, then at least reference it, because you kind of have to go figure out where that is. I had to call and ask staff, you know, where that fits in. And then within that, there is an appeals or dispute resolution process that includes a livestock appeals committee that has a very specific structure, which includes livestock operators as well as wildlife advocates. We think that's great. We encourage that to remain in there. But the current policy for the department is to use the Wolf Advisory Group in that context. And given the encouraging progress we have with the Wolf Advisory Group on building relationships amongst these different interests, to then have them be, in essence, a jury on whether or not compensation is going to be paid, I think may create a very unsupportive or unhelpful dynamic within the WAG going forward. So I would encourage you to encourage the department to find different body or different individuals to serve as that livestock appeals committee. I mean, again, the concept is great, but being as that for instance, there very well may be something that comes before us that would involve a specific member of the WAG based on last year, having us then serve as the entity that's recommending whether or not compensation should be paid, I think would be just really create a difficult, if not impossible, dynamic. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. Howard Wilson. Leonard, it's up to you.
Stretches, I'll move over here. Thank you all for having me today. I'm here representing the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council, which hopefully most of you know about. We've been around for a long time. We've started a conflict predators committee about 2 years ago. Spent a lot of time doing research. Had Jay with us on the Gonzaga Wolf Cry panel, Cry Wolf panel earlier this year. Anyway, I'm here today to basically talk about three things, and I'm going to add the fourth one, which that last point that was just made I would totally agree with as far as the people on the WAG being the jury, if you will, for conflict specialists. I think that's a dangerous situation because of some of the people on the WAG could very likely and probably have been affected already. It's a conflict of interest. But basically just like to make three requests because I'm probably sure I'm going to run out of time here pretty soon. But made a lot of presentations, and I've spent a lot of time doing education on this topic to people because there seems to be a lot of confusion, and it is very controversial, as all of you are well aware of. But the three points being, in the original wolf management plan, there's a quite a bit of stipulation for translocation. That study has none of those studies. We'd just like to see if they could get started. I know that's going to be very costly. And going to take some time, but it seems like it would happen faster to help us reach our recovery goals in this state if we could get that started. The second thing is because of the problems we have in eastern Washington with wolves and the concentrations, we've seen a 30% growth again this year, to look at amending the wolf recovery plan to do something like Oregon has done with the regional delisting idea. I know there's some barriers to that as well, but we'd just like to see if you guys could look into that. And then our last point concerns something that comes into our state somewhat, but I know we spent quite a bit of money on, which is the woodland caribou herd, which there's somewhere between 13 and 8 left of. And all Canada's done some stuff for that, Idaho as well. But we'd like to see if there's anything, you know, whatever we can do to try and help maintain that population or keep it from declining any further. We feel that is a truly endangered species, and it really needs some help. So I appreciate your guys' time today and listening to me, and thank you.
Thank you, Leonard. Ken Miller and Howard.
Good afternoon. I'm Howard Wilson. I have a 260-acre parcel that has sustained over $50,000 in bear damage in the last 2 years. It took a master hunter hunting without bait 166 hours to kill two bears damaging trees on mine and a neighbor's property. Our hunter burned out and retired early. Policy changes by the animal conflict section are causing small forest landowners increasing timber losses in the tens of thousands of dollars and need to be immediately reversed. Over the protests of small forest landowners, Objective 23 of the current game management plan included the objective: improve and expand WDFW's black bear tree damage program by incorporating alternate strategies beyond existing techniques, which result in an overall 10% reduction in the number of permits requested to lethally remove black bears, while maintaining or decreasing the amount of bear-caused timber damage. The animal conflict section was transferred in 2013 to the Game Management Department. They started making depredation permit changes in 2014, which appear aimed to support the goal of reduced number of lethal bear permits. However, these permit changes have resulted in increased timber damage. These changes include, in 2014, using a three-year-old email from Assistant Attorney General Joe Pinesco, subject agents of the state, as justification to stop master hunters from hunting over bait, which made them much less effective. Reducing the depredation permit season from 4 months to 2 months, a 50% reduction, cutting the area master hunter could hunt near a damage point from 1/2 mile radius circle to 1/4 mile circle, a reduction by over 2/3. Not allowing master hunters to keep bears and requiring landowners and hunters to use costly and cumbersome processes to dispose of bear hides, carcasses, and gallbladders. The above changes make our hunters much less effective and increase our expenses. Small forest landowners need to be able to use any and all forms of lethal bear removal, hound hunting, snare trapping, and master hunters, depending on which works best for them. The animal conflict section is not incorporating alternate strategies beyond existing techniques as specified in the game management plan. They are reducing or eliminating effective tools that small forest landowners have historically used to control problem bears. All of these policy changes are greatly increasing bear timber damage for small forest landowners and need to be immediately reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard.
Brett?
Yes.
Howard, are you and Mr. Miller involved in the group that meets with Stephanie?
Yes, we are. And we also briefed the Bear Management Subcommittee in Issaquah about a week ago.
Okay. Both of you have been to the last information meetings testifying on this. So
we've been working this issue for about a year, but we have not seem to be getting any results.
There again, from my aspect, this is going to be really good for, looks like, in our part of the world. Hopefully we can get it to where it's good for you guys in your world. So I guess I'm going to ask of you, have patience and keep.
We really need master hunters back with bait. That's critical. It makes them totally ineffective to be out there without bait. It's just, it burns them out and they don't get the animals. On the two pieces of property that our master hunter was working, he was on one about 95 hours. He saw the bears a number of times. He had multiple camera pictures of them, but he never got a shot.
Right. What was the idea of reducing it from a half mile to a quarter of a mile?
You'd have to ask the Fish and Wildlife. I don't know.
Nate, you know?
The half mile to our regulations never existed. We were not informed that was a criteria when we inherited the program from law enforcement. Quarter mile was based on the accuracy of what a root runner can do in the damage area and trying to affect the bears that come in the particular damage area. That's how it was originally agreed or assessed. Additionally, though, as I mentioned, we're working with these landowners and trying to address their issues. We're developing through the subdivision criteria that would hopefully address more specific small timber owners in a different way than the previous program. This program was established based on what I would say commercial, large commercial timber properties, and therefore these buffers made sense on large commercial timber properties, like a 5 mile buffer to run hounds. That doesn't make sense for these gentlemen.
Right.
Their property is much smaller. You know, it's very, we're considering options such as the whole property as the boundary for the hunt for that damage issue. So we're trying to address these concerns. These are concerns that they have brought forward to us as well.
And like the baiting issue, is that?
Again, that was one of those things statewide. It was not permitted. However, there was an exception made in Region 6 that we have since been informed of, which is where Mr. Wilson's property is.
Well, this is some 2013, copies of a 2013 permit. And in that, you'll see that bait was permitted when enforcement had it. Also, that it was a half-mile damage radius.
But do you think that's something you could work with these guys on?
Oh, yeah, we are. Yes, sir, we are. Definitely. Yes, we are.
Well, I guess that's all I'm going to ask of you. Will you stick with it for a little bit?
We're sticking with it.
Okay.
Yeah, I know you've been here before. And I've reviewed the documents that you've provided with photos and all that. So I know that we're aware of it, and it's in process,
yeah.
as Jay says.
We really appreciate your help and support.
We're aware very much of your concerns. Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess my question would be, is how long is this going to be in process?
Thank you.
Good question, yeah.
I mean, it's been in process. It's been a process going for a couple of years. I've seen Ken. He showed up a number of times and doesn't seem to be satisfied with what's going on. It just bothers me that this has taken so long, Stephanie. Yes, ma'am. And I know you're really trying. You've done a great job so far as I can tell. But
no, I understand, and I fully agree that
the agency and these timber owners have been dealing with this for years, quite frankly.
Right.
And that is why we asked for the recommend. We made a recommendation through our chain of command to form a subcommittee so that we could address this and focus attention to it. And we have staff stationed across the state that are committed, and we're meeting. Actually, our next meeting is in July, but we're meeting approximately every 2 months, and everybody's been assigned a specific task. Our ultimate goal is to actually have recommendations put forward to our senior staff before the beginning of next season. And when I say that, I know these guys are going to start to panic and say, what does that mean? And what that means is by January, we intend to have recommendations for revisions to this program so that next year we can enter into the bear damage season with a new process, one that meets our both of our needs and their needs and is a collaborative approach to getting this addressed. We're working with these gentlemen. They've been able to provide me some good input since, actually, quite frankly, we had a, after last year when we initiated the program, under the guise that we were given through law enforcement, we had an after-the-season sort of debriefing, and Ken provided us with some good feedback on that and some recommendations for the upcoming season. We decided that we would try to stay status quo with what we had initiated or what we had used last year with a few minor changes. And as we go through this process, we are learning and discovering other things that had been in place that were never really institutionalized. It was in somebody else's, you know, area and never conveyed it to others. So we're going through that learning process with them. But the idea that we would stay status quo as much as possible this season and then have a new program in place by next season. That's our objective.
So you anticipate by the 2016 season,
yes, sir,
as we enter that, you will have new rules in place?
Yes, sir.
Does that help, Ken?
I could just add, we're very encouraged by the process that Stephanie has embarked, and we testified to that effect at the last meeting. We're still nervous and antsy as hell about the details because she's being pretty closed-lipped. Her ears seem to be wide open, but her mouth has been pretty quiet for the last number of months. So we're hopeful.
Thank you, Andy Mesogenic. My Dutch is it is Dutch, right?
Yugoslav.
Okay.
So I'm trying to up my game here with a few short slides that are part of the presentation that we made to Stephanie's group a couple of weeks ago. So these are just some excerpts from that. And Chairman Smith and members of the commission, I've gotten bear damage every year since 1999. I'm disproportionately impacted because I don't have more acreage to average acreage with this particular horribly damaged hotspot that I've been talking to you for about 15 years on. My damage is approaching, if I use the formulas that industry puts out, $500,000 on that 42-acre parcel at harvest time. And I'm now being told I will no longer be assured additional tags if needed during the damage period. The issue is not population management. It's about damage abatement. Small forest landowners are only about 10% of that red line that you can barely see there. So we don't understand what the problem is. Yet many of the rules and processes feel punitive rather than helpful at this point. Where is the disproportionate impact language in the long-term management plan, the WACs, or the small business economic impact statement? Other crop and critter producers, as you've heard today, actually get physical and financial help from WDFW. We get none, yet we provide the best habitat. Other crop and critter producers are complimented on their societal and wildlife contributions in the long-term management plan. Why aren't timberland owners seeing and feeling some of this love? If I were the commission for a day, I'd empower WDFW with language similar to this. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife acknowledges that bear damage has a disproportionate impact on small forest landowners. bear damage on small forest ownerships can be financially catastrophic and last for decades before remedial action can be taken, thus further increasing the likelihood of conversion of the land to non-habitat uses. The department recognizes that geographic areas where extensive ongoing damage occurs are predictable and vary with timber stand ages. Landowners in no known high damage areas will be supported by the department in the form of an expedited and simplified permitting process to protect their verified high damage property throughout the spring damage period. Thank you for listening again. I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to see you. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances.
I'll do it, Ken.
It's okay. Right. Thank you.
And Heather Hansen and Andy.
Good afternoon. My name is Andy Misogynik, and I'm the Burned Out Master Hunter. I've been working on bear damage with Scott Harris out of Region 6, and I got to say, he's been excellent to deal with. He's been a great partner in this whole process. I get calls from him, or he takes calls from me, and after hours, on weekends, on his days off, the guy works his tail off. So my interaction with that part of the conflict resolution or conflict management person is great. I got a couple of questions. Basically, are master hunters acting as agents of the state when we are doing these damage conflict or the depredation permits? And the reason I ask is because possession of the bear after the kill now seems to be an issue. 2 years ago, I shot about a 310-pound boar on one of the properties that I oversee, and I was allowed to keep that bear. Last year, I shot a 280-pound bear, had to turn it in. Now, I want you to understand, one of these bears was 75 or 80 yards downhill in a very steep ravine like this, and I'm the only guy there. I got to get this bear up and out. Then I get it home. I get it skinned. I get it set up. By the time I was done that day, I was about 9.5 hours in, and I got to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning. It's a volunteer effort. So I'd like to, it would be nice if I'm doing all of this work, hey, it would be great if I could keep the bear. If I can't, I understand why. But then I don't necessarily understand why, but then that goes to my second point. I'm also a service volunteer. So I worked all of these hours, and if you do the math, 160-some-odd hours, that's a full month of work for somebody's day job. Now, I'm a commercial banker, and I actually work more than that my day job. So imagine doing my regular day job at about 55 hours a week, adding this onto it over the last 2 months, I was working my tail off and I lost about 12 pounds. So can I get the service hours for it? That would be great. Then that way I make sure I maintain my master hunter status, I get my hours and all of that, and that's not an issue. Because one of the primary issues with service hours is master hunter hours is dealing with private landowners, as well as wildlife issues. Well, this mates right into that. And I hopefully take some weight off of Department of Fish and Wildlife staff. My goal is not to add work. My goal is to take it away. The last piece that I've got is when you look at Initiative I-594, Department of Fish and Wildlife sidestepped the issue as far as the hunter education people, and they said that they're acting as agents of the state, in essence, because they were volunteers for a law enforcement officer or for a law enforcement agency. Well, I was a commissioned law officer with the Whatcom County Sheriff's Department from 94 to 96. And I don't know how many of these volunteers have been commissioned law officers. I put in a lot of volunteer hours to get my Master Hunter education done. I've been doing it for 16 or 17 years. So why can I not, a service volunteer, be dealt with as an agent of the state so that we can help out our landowners and we can use bait and do things and be really effective, as opposed to me having to spend basically a huge amount of time going out there and trying to tag one of these bears. So, any questions?
Go on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess maybe you can answer it, or somebody in the audience. One time you got to keep the bear, the next time you didn't get to keep the bear. Policy changes, bad bear, good bear, what was the deal?
All of these bears are, I don't know if anybody here's ever hunted bears, but they're an excellent quarry. I mean, they come in silent, they've got bionic hearing, you cock your rifle at 52 yards away and they bolt. I think it was more a policy issue. I don't think it was. I don't think there was a WAC or an RCW change, but there was a change in policy somehow, some way, some shape or form. And the reason why I bring up the agent of the state issue is because there are qualifications or exemptions for hunters when they're acting as agents of the state to use certain things. Also under RCW, give me a second, 77-12-240, the director could actually allow for the retention of the bear in a situation like this where you have somebody go out and do that. It says the disposition or the bear is at the discretion of the director. And by the way, welcome from Idaho. I've fished there many times. So I don't know the reason why. And when we sit there and I got to say, you know, as Ken had said, Stephanie's pretty tight-lipped. Well, Scott's a little bit tight-lipped as well, and they won't tell us what the machinations are behind the scenes, and so that doesn't build a whole lot of confidence in what's going on. We don't know why the changes are being made. There was one thing mentioned earlier by Howard where he said we had a quarter-mile radius circle in the beginning of the time. The initial two permits that I got on his property were issued that way, but thankfully working with Scott and the rest of the folks who are in the conflict management team, they eliminated that quarter-mile circle. So then I was able to hunt the entire property. The problem is that one of the first nights I was out there, I was 0.33 miles away from my damage area, and I had a bear run across the road in front of me and stop up in there. He was headed up into the damage area, and I can't shoot him. So that's some of the things that we don't understand, and I'm literally a boots-on-the-ground guy. I hump my ass off, sorry. But, you know, we work really, really hard to do this. It would be nice to see some things, and people ask me, what do I do with a bear? We make some great sausage out of it. You know, we use everything that we can on it. If I don't get to retain the bear, that's fine. We take him to the mission, and they really appreciate it. But I would like to hopefully, me and other master hunters, be able to get some service hours for that so that we, you know, this is right in line with what those hours are for.
I think your points are well taken. Kent, you wanted to...
Yeah, I think I can clarify the question a little bit. Actually, the master hunter for bear depredation started about 5 or 6 years ago, and we really thought this was going to be a win-win-win kind of a thing. And as I understand it, of course, enforcement was, and Stephanie talked to this too, but when enforcement started, the master hunter program, or master hunter program started when enforcement was handling the depredation program, they asked the Attorney General's office for a ruling or an opinion on the use of bait. Enforcement interpreted that opinion, which we can't see, but interpreted that as it's okay to use bait. And then as Stephanie pointed out, when her department took that over, looked at that same apparently opinion and decided they can't use bait. So I think that's where the change actually occurred.
Thank you, Kent.
There again, just to join the flurry, this should be pretty well black and white when you guys go out there, because there again, you can shoot the bear over the hill. You don't get to keep it. They can go pack the dang thing out. But no, it should be pretty well in black and white when you guys get to keep the bear.
Well, I mean, the one bear that I shot this year, the first bear I shot this year, it went down off the hill about 160 yards out. Now, I've got a half-mile spool of rope, and I, you know, this is one-man recovery on a bear. And you know, from the time that I located the bear to the time I got him up to the road was 3.5 hours. That's a heck of a lot of work and a heck of a lot of effort to make sure that I took the bear out. And I took the bear out whole. I did not gut it down in the field, because my thing is when I got it back up there, I took it home. I cleaned and dressed the bear there so that when I gave it to the mission, that meat was 100% dirt-free, hair-free, absolute quality. I mean,
But still, even at that, yeah. If you want to give it to the mission, that's great. Going into it, you should be able to know how the game's going to be played.
Oh, and I knew how the game was being played this year, absolutely. There's no confusion on my part, but it would be nice to have some sort of, I'm not saying compensation, but some sort of an incentive for the hunter to participate, because otherwise you're just going out there and sweating and spending gas money and spending time and, I went through $45 worth of batteries. I bought 3 new cameras this year. I got a total of 12 that I run. Literally, I start at a wide net, and I get them right in. And I kind of figure out where the bears go, where the bears travel. It's a lot of time, a lot of expense, a lot of days. I spent 30-some-odd days out on the properties. Oh, I love it. I mean, I got a good tan, so.
I have one more question.
You bet, sir.
With a certain amount of sympathy to small business owners like these small timberland owners, a little bit of damage becomes a pretty high percent of loss to them. And how would you as a master hunter categorize the benefit and efficiencies of baiting and getting the job done as to not being able to bait?
Here's the thing is that it provides a place for the bear and the hunter to meet at a place of the hunter's choosing. The bears that I shot this year, quite honestly, were incidental. I'm walking along the road, and now this is a area behind 2 lock gates, free fire zone once we're there. And I'm going out there, and the first bear is looking at me from 45 yards in the forest, and all I see is the head. I dial up the scope, zip one right in here. The bear heads down the hill, and that was the one that was a horrible recovery. This last one, again, this is Tuesday night. I'm walking back to my truck. I'm done with my hunting for the day, and I hear some crashing in the woods right next to me off to my left. I raise my rifle. The bear comes out. Boom. Shot. Drop. Right on the spot. So those were encounters that I didn't choose. But, again, it took me a heck of a lot of time and a heck of a lot of effort to get to where I needed to go. Now, Scott and I have talked a lot about the use of bait, and I agree with him on a lot of parts of it, is that you don't want to have bait out there all the time because you don't want to attract bears from other areas. You don't want to make it a magnet for and create a problem, basically. But if you allow the master hunter some way, shape, or form, some way to, for a specific period of time, and at first I was kind of dubious of the 15-day permit process, but Ralph ran it really well, and the extensions were really good. Allow the master hunter to do maybe a limited amount, a limited time, because the thing is when the guys go out and they do the snares, that bait's working 24/7. When the Department of Fish and Wildlife uses a culvert trap out there to catch a problem bear in a residential area, that bait's working 24/7. But when I'm out there, or I'm trying to cover, this one property. And again, Scott and I have devised a plan to, maybe get another guy out there that you can work with. So, one, you work as a team, but you're not stepping on each other. But when I forgot my train of thought. But basically, figure out a way so that you can put the bear and the hunter in the same spot in a place of their choosing, so that you can get it done quickly. Because the problem is that over this 2-month period that I was out there, 30 some odd days, 160 some odd hours, there's a potential for that damage to happen again and again and again. Yeah. And if it's a damage issue, let's get out there and take care of the damaged bear as quickly as possible and then back off. And if the damage is abated, great, done. If the damage continues, okay, time to renew the permit, time to go out and prosecute the next bear. But again, like I say, the work that Scott's does is great. He's been a good partner for the last couple of years. I cleaned up a whole bunch of trash, and so if you ever saw the big pile of tires at Region 6 office, that was me. But Any other questions?
I think your points have been well stated, and I see Stephanie's head nodding up and down in the back. So tight lip, but body language says says she's with you.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
And thanks again. Heather, you have the last word.
Oh, boy. Well, on behalf of the Washington Farm Forestry Association, thank you for this opportunity. And I want to thank Stephanie. I know she has been working very, very hard on this and clearly worked hard getting ready for today, too. Our biggest concern, as you've heard, is with the policy that implements the bare timber damage program. And I'll try not to repeat anything that's already been said. But the current program is very complicated and inefficient for both landowners and for department staff. And we would love to see program improvements that would both help decrease timber damage and make the program just easier to use so everybody on both sides of the table can understand it. Of particular concern in this WAC proposal, in new WAC 232-36-320 sub 2D, it states that department shall ensure bear removals are consistent with population management objectives. We believe that section ought to read, the department shall ensure bear removals are consistent with landowner objectives for protection of property. The purpose of the bear depredation program is to remove wildlife that's destroying property. Population levels are quite healthy. They're growing. Depredation permits are just a tiny portion of the total bear harvest. And so we'd like to see some emphasis on protecting that property, because it provides an invaluable resource to the state as wildlife habitat. And so in return for providing this habitat, as landowners need a manageable system to protect their investment, and we need the department to help support landowners in protecting that investment. The program changes that we've seen, as you heard from the last three people, I suspect a lot of them do have to do with transferring the program from enforcement to wildlife. And I suspect that a lot of them may have to do with just differences between different regions. But the real point here is that how the heck are policy changes made? Right now, we don't know. And we don't know why these things changed. We don't know if it was just misunderstanding. But we have a list of like 25 things that from our side of the table don't make sense, and we don't understand why they're that way. And maybe we all just need to sit down and talk more. And I have high hopes that I want to believe everything Stephanie said and that we're going to get there. But right now, there's just a whole lot of confusion out there, I think, on both sides. And I think it's making life more difficult for your staff, too. So we'd love to understand why things are the way they are and how we can make it more efficient. And we'd also like to see the department acknowledge the bear damage does have a disproportionate impact on small timber landowners, and I think Stephanie did earlier. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.